On March 28, 2008, the Honorable J. Harvey Wilkinson III of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit presented the 10th Annual Henry J. Abraham Distinguished Lecture, hosted by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. The lecture was part of the Virginia Festival of the Book and was moderated by Robert O'Neill.
Now to our speaker of the day. We in this community rightly claim Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson III as our federal judge. Now, that term should not for a moment imply that any of us could possibly influence the judicial process, which has been his life. Indeed, of all those whom I've known who have served on the federal bench, I can't think of anyone whose standards of integrity, impartiality, and propriety were possibly superior to his. Nor by this phrase do I mean to suggest only that we claim him as a friend, as a neighbor, as a former member of the university's law faculty and of its board of visitors, and of course, along with Henry, the recipient of the university's highest accolade, the Thomas Jefferson Award in Law. Although surely we do prize all these contacts. And for me, there is yet another quite personal dimension. A few months ago, I had the delight of welcoming Judge Wilkinson to what may be the most exclusive club in the legal profession, and that is parents of second-generation Supreme Court law clerks, on the occasion of his daughter Porter's appointment as a law clerk to Chief Justice Roberts. Beyond any of these admirable qualities, I envision one other claim when I cite him as our federal judge. Within hours of the announcement that Justice Lewis Powell would retire from the Supreme Court, I had a call from a Daily Progress reporter who was seeking names for possible successors. And with uncharacteristic certainty and clarity, I said, it's very simple. We have in this community, in my judgment, the person who would be ideally suited to succeed Justice Powell. He is, in fact, one of Justice Powell's principal protégés, and I think it would be an admirable choice. I support that view with just a couple of very brief illustrations. One comes from a field of special interest to me. It concerns academic freedom. Justice Powell, as many of you know, and as Barbara's book, which we'll be talking about in more detail tomorrow afternoon, superbly illustrates, Justice Powell was the architect of the link between academic freedom and faculty judgment about university admissions when he wrote the critical opinion in the Bakke case sustaining the use of race by selective colleges and universities. For Judge Wilkinson, the context was quite different, but the sentiment and the response were strikingly similar. Several years ago, he concurred in a judgment about limits on the use of state-owned or state-leased computers to access salacious material from the internet. But he was deeply troubled by the majority's rather callous view of academic freedom. So he wrote a long and extremely thoughtful, indeed eloquent, separate opinion in which he explained the rationale for academic freedom within the university setting about as forcefully and cogently as I've seen it done anywhere. He is also, and this is especially appropriate for us at the Thomas Jefferson Center, he's also been a forceful champion of free speech and freedom of the press in other settings. In one notable case, indeed, educating the Supreme Court about expression on public sidewalks, something which the justices seemed to understand well enough when the walks surrounded their own building, but not when it came to the venue of a Maryland post office. Much, much more could be said about Judge Wilkinson's remarkable achievements and his extraordinary jurisprudence, including even a few other reasons why we in Charlottesville are so proud to claim him as our federal judge. But the time that remains is properly his, and we all await with keen interest his singular view from the bench. Judge Wilkinson.
Wonderful to see everybody here. I realize the special sacrifice you make to come on a Friday afternoon. I really appreciate you being here. Barbara, you and Bob O'Neill have done such a wonderful job with the Abraham Lecture over the years, and I've been in the audience many a time, and there's just a very distinguished group of folks that you've invited here. And I really appreciate the way in which you've made this lectureship a fitting honor to our friend Hemery. Also, really pleased to see Dean John Jeffries of the University of Virginia Law School here in the audience. He's been a friend of mine for 40 years. And I just want to say what a magnificent dean of this law school he has been, and I'm honored to be his friend. Hemery, your writings on the court are unsurpassed in their wisdom and their eloquence and their erudition. And each spring I look forward to this gathering of your friends and your colleagues and devoted students, just to tell you how much you mean to all of us. And you and Mildred are certainly one of Charlottesville's first and finest couples. And we have been touched over the years at various occasions, including those wonderful birthday parties that Mildred throws for you. We've been touched by your warmth and your personal magnanimity as a couple. And it's an honor to give this lecture in your name. I've become, over the years, my talks have become a little bit less prepared and a little bit more sort of extemporaneous, and I want to try to adopt a bit of a conversational tone when we talk about the questions that come to me about the federal judiciary. I realize that there are a number of lawyers in the audience, but also a great many non-lawyers, mercifully. and I hope I might have something of interest to say to both. I just thought as a theme for the talk that I would take up some questions that are most frequently asked me about life on the federal bench. This is a good chance to try to think through and to provide some answers. One of the questions that's asked me most frequently are, what was the greatest surprise that you encountered when you became a federal judge? And I guess the greatest surprises are, to me, the cases that I've had to sit on involving problems that I'd never possibly anticipated. I've been on the bench now for 24 years, and I think back to the time of my confirmation that I never dreamed of the impact that the internet would have, or how much litigation the internet-related litigation would surface. We spent an awful lot of time trying to adapt traditional principles of law in the area of libel and slander and trademark infringement and personal jurisdiction to this extraordinary new world. You could have knocked me over with a feather at the time of my confirmation if you'd said, well, you're going to have to deal with a lot of cases involving the internet. In 1984, we never dreamed of the dimension of the AIDS epidemic. That's generated a good many cases as to how the Americans for Disabilities Act applies to AIDS and the extent to which AIDS in different stages should be treated as a disability under that statute. In 1984, that was unknown. And of course, who could have anticipated 9/11 and the cases of first impression that would have that arose from that horrible day? So what I guess my biggest surprise is that I encountered a world that I never dreamed of at the time that I went on the bench, and problems that I never could have foreseen. And some of the people that are up before the United States Senate today will be serving in as late as 2030 or 2040. And we can take an educated guess as to what they will be dealing with in the future. We can say, well, they'll be dealing with the shortages and dislocations brought about by global warming, and interpreting Congress's efforts to deal with that. And we'll be dealing with the cases that may arise out of some unforeseen pandemic. We'll certainly be dealing with bioethical issues, where we try to capture all the great benefits of scientific progress, and yet at the same time, I hope, are wary of the profound dangers that come with tampering with genetic materials and the sort of basic building blocks of our very beings and the universe. And we can foresee all kinds of things that may be over the horizon, but even guessing about bioethics and pandemic and global warming, we're really going to miss so much. We're not going to be able to tell what those judges in 2030 are going to be grappling with. And what does this suggest? And again, my friend Dean Jeffries has touched on this earlier in an article, but it suggests that when we follow judicial confirmation proceedings, we not try to put an excessive emphasis upon litmus tests and upon responses to a specific issue that dominates the headlines during the present day. You may be pro-life on abortion, you may be pro-choice, or you may be somewhere in between. And whatever your position is, I certainly respect it. And I don't mean to downgrade the importance of the issue, but abortion should not be a litmus test for whom we want as a federal judge, and nor should any other single issue. What you're looking for is somebody who's going to take unforeseen and unanticipated problems and hopefully have the character and the temperament and the balance and the seasoning to deal with things we know not of. And sometimes I think that these confirmation battles in Congress, if they suffer from one thing, is that they suffer from maybe too contemporary a perspective. I'm asked a lot, well, what are the big cases that you've decided? And my response to that is, there are no big cases. There are no little cases. They're just cases that matter to you. And if I can draw an analogy to the field of medicine, sometimes physicians, especially academic physicians, get very excited over complicated medical problems. A disease that's very rare, or a disease with all sorts of dimensions and complications and mysteries and the rest involved in it. And those may be the diseases that end up in the professor's slideshow in medical school. And similarly, judges and lawyers get all wound up about cases that are intellectually fascinating and cases that draw big public attention. And what I would suggest to you is that there may be a basic disconnect between the fascination of the professions with the unusual and the intellectual challenging, and what our basic obligation is as public servants, which is to treat every person on an operating table or every person before the court with equal conscientiousness and dignity. I want to tell you a little story. Justice Powell, after he retired from the Supreme Court, came down, sat with the Fourth Circuit. And the first case he had was a Social Security disability case. The medical record was very detailed. There were no large issues of law involved. There was a history of disability, and the question of whether the person was disabled was a bit on the edge. And I was surprised as I heard Justice Powell ask questions from the bench just how familiar he was with the details of this person's medical history. And I got back into conference and I said, Justice Powell, you have decided cases that shook the nation on abortion and capital punishment and church-state relations and affirmative action and many other things. And I'm amazed that you took such an interest in this. And he said, well, it matters, doesn't it? And yes, it does. Everything matters. Those of us on the inside of institutions and bureaucracies need to understand the mindset and the wishes of those on the outside. When you deal with the Internal Revenue Service or the Division of Motor Vehicles, you know what means something to you to get a voice on the end of the phone? To have somebody not play a shell game with you? To have a prompt and courteous decision? So those of us on the inside of a court system need to think about the folks on the outside and not just take our own sweet time. People want prompt decisions, they want courtesy, they want us to agree, but that's not always going to happen. But what they can expect is some promptness and courtesy and conscientiousness, just the way we would like from the IRS and the DMV. Another thing people ask me about, they say, gee, as a judge, it must be a terribly monastic lifestyle. I think when my kids were growing up, they thought it was really boring. And sort of lamented the fact that I wasn't a firefighter or something and could tell them about the fires that I put out that day. And it is a little bit of a monastic lifestyle, being a judge. You don't participate at all in partisan politics. You don't get involved in campaigns. If you were to go by the courthouse parking lot, you wouldn't find any political bumper stickers. They're very refreshing. There's no fundraising. We can't be involved in that. You have to be careful in your relationship with lawyers. And I love to have dinner with my lawyer friends, but not if the case is anywhere near me. Try not to run too many red lights. Famous last words, I'll probably commit a traffic violation on the way home. Somebody breaks in line in front of you, go right ahead. As a judge, you do not want to create a scene. So is it monastic? Yes. I suppose the greatest symbol of judicial monasticism is those black robes we wear on the bench. Did you know that not all judicial robes are black? The Maryland Court of Appeals has red robes. They're really beautiful. Those of us with black robes envy them. So they say, that's the monasticism, that black robe. Why do you wear that thing? Is it to inspire awe on the part of people in the courtroom? I hope not. A sense of solemnity, yes. But awe, no. Is it to create distance between those on the bench and those in the audience? I hope not. I mean, what purposes do uniforms serve, be they black robes or the raiments of a minister or the white coat of a physician or the uniform of a baseball player? What purposes do these uniforms serve? Well, I can say as a judge that it's not to intimidate you, it's to help me. And I think every person that wears a uniform, whether it's a judge or a policeman or a minister or anybody else, might take the view that this uniform is not to puff that person up or to create a sense of hierarchy, but it's to help the person that wears it. In my case, it reminds me of the highest aspirations of the judicial profession and how, despite the many mistakes I may make, I'm going to stumble and get up and try to live up to what that black robe represents. And that's what I think any kind of garment represents. It's a call to the person who wears it. It's not an attempt to bully or intimidate or create distance with somebody else. And these monastic impositions, they're really not so bad. In fact, they come in handy. Before going on the bench, I used to do some fundraising. I didn't really like it. I found it very difficult to ask people for money, even in a really good cause. And after going on the bench, I'm ethically prohibited from even raising a dime for a lot of obvious reasons. You don't want a judge twisting your arm for money. So it's a relief when someone says, "Would you help us with fundraising for this or that enterprise?" And I say, "Oh, I'd love to." But I'm ethically forbidden. So what I'm saying is, don't feel too sorry for us. We choose it. Some folks have asked me, is the Supreme Court becoming more liberal or more conservative? People want to know that. That's a hard question to answer because the signals are always mixed. I think in the 1970s, the court, late 1960s and 70s, the court was pretty liberal by today's standards, much more liberal than the present court is in certain circumstances. In three cases, Dandridge v. Williams, Lindsay v. Norman, and the San Antonio versus Independent Rodriguez, it was a very active and strong and articulate liberal group, including one of the finest justices, nicest men that ever served on the Supreme Court, Justice Brennan. But they wanted to have a constitutional right to a certain level of public assistance and a constitutional right to a certain level of public housing and a constitutional right to a certain level of education. And of course, if you push that, then you're going to have to have, there's going to be a terrible temptation for the justice to say at what level those non-textual constitutional rights should be funded. If you go down that route, there's a grave danger that the judiciary will take over the basic function of the political process, which is to decide who gets and who pays. And the court in the late 1960s and 1970s had justices that were anxious, I think, to broaden access to the courts through habeas corpus, and several justices were willing to strike down capital punishment as an absolute matter, as in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And you don't have anywhere near that degree of domestic interventionism on the court today, and many of the battles are fought that used to be fought over constitutional law are now fought over statutory interpretation, which is a terribly important battleground, but a somewhat narrower one than the constitutional differences that prevailed in the 60s and 70s. The court, even in the halcyon days of the Warren Court, the Supreme Court was very reluctant to intervene in the Vietnam War, as unpopular as that war was. Even the more liberal justices, by and large, resisted the invitations and temptations to interfere with the conduct of foreign wars. And I think, by and large, the court today, whatever may be the feelings of the individual justices on the matter of Iraq, they haven't intervened in any basic way with the conduct of the Iraq War. The war on terror, the struggle against terrorism, is a little tougher kind of thing because it's a different kind of war. It's more prolonged, it's more shadowy, the enemy is more diffuse, and it's not going to end on the deck of an aircraft carrier off the coast of Japan with General Douglas MacArthur striding on deck to accept the Japanese offer of surrender. So it's the indefinite nature of this war that makes questions of detention and surveillance so very hard for the courts, and finding that particular balance in a war of indefinite duration has been, to understate the matter, a very challenging task. I don't think judges think, when we get on the bench, well, am I going to rule in a liberal or conservative fashion? We just rule case by case, and sort of the larger chips fall where they may, and it's up to others mainly to look at the overall direction. Our perspective is the individual case. I would say to you a couple things that make the judicial process very unique. One, we don't log roll cases. I have, as long as I've been on the bench, I've never seen log rolling where a judge said to another, well, I'll vote for you in this case if you'll vote for me in that case. That just doesn't happen. And imagine how unfair it would be to a litigant who has no control over what other cases are going through the process at the same time if judges were to log roll in that kind of fashion. So there's none of that horse trading and vote swapping in the judicial process that one would see in the political process, and that on occasion makes things move. The other thing, and I say this because I know it's on many people's minds, it's been my personal experience that the judicial process is not a partisan one. Media makes a lot over whether we were appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic presidents. And I know, to be honest, that there was a lot of skepticism after the Bush v. Gore decision, when the more conservative justices voted one way and the four liberal justices voted another way. All I can say to you is that it's good not to ascribe motives to people, and as a general matter, to give folks the benefit of good faith. And I have to tell you from my own experience that there are deep disagreements and deep philosophical disagreements on the court. But I honestly don't think that we're a partisan group. We take very seriously the obligation to set political partisanship aside when we go on the bench. And that's every judge with whom I serve. And I would hate to see skepticism about any one case contradict at least what I think most judges feel are lifetimes of experience with a process in which people are trying to do the best for the litigants before them. Now, I get lots and lots of questions about law clerks. Lots of them. In fact, people seem to be a lot more fascinated with law clerks than they are with about judges. And I'm really glad that some of my law clerks are here. I choose lots of law clerks from the University of Virginia because the university trains them so well. I have two of my law clerks, Elizabeth McGill and Barbara Armacost, who are on the faculty here, and a third, Leslie Kendrick, who's going to be joining the faculty next year, and they're all women of exceptional talent and capability. A couple of my law clerks are here today. Allie Orr, will you stand up? Please. And Paul Crane, will you stand up? And Dan Bress, where are you? Okay, there you are. Is Catherine Toomey here? Well, there she is. She's going to be my law clerk next year. Now, if you look at them all, you'll notice they have one thing in common. They're very, very young. And I'll tell you another little story about Justice Powell. I love Lewis Powell stories. He came on the Supreme Court, and he was a senior partner at Hunt & Williams, and he was 64 years old when he came on the Supreme Court. And he was stuck. I was a law clerk for him his first year, so he was stuck with four very young, green, junior people like me. And there was a case involving garnishment procedures, you know, when someone's wages are garnished by a creditor, could be an automobile dealer or a finance agency or something, and it garnishes the wages if the particular individual is behind in paying a particular debt. Well, back in the early 1970s, any lawyer worth a salt would have known the ins and outs of garnishment. And so I was sitting in there, and this case came up, and I said, Justice Powell, would you kind of, we can go over that a lot in the courses that I took. I wonder if you'd explain to me what a garnishment procedure is. His jaw just dropped. He couldn't believe after years of being a senior partner at Hunt & Williams and dealing with lawyers in their 40s and 50s with years of experience behind us that he was saddled in being a Supreme Court justice with these three very junior, callow people. And so you look at these young folks today that just stood up and you say, what? This is all the assistants you have? How can you possibly get by? What in the world is this system? Does this system have to commend it? Well, you know, it has a lot to commend it. For one thing, I think our brightest young men and women learn a sense of respect for the judicial system. And it's great training for them when they go out in the world, become lawyers. And the other thing that's good about it is that the young law clerks which come on, they only stay with us for a single year as a rule. And this is a good thing because it prevents judges from becoming over-reliant on staff. And that can be a bit of a problem. Justice Louis Brandeis once said that the thing he loved about the Supreme Court is the justices did their own work. And I think that the constant turnover of law clerks means that you don't become overly reliant on staff. You have to keep on top of the issues yourself. But A great thing about the law clerks is that they bring a diversity of perspective. You know, we're in the habit of naming our generations, I guess. There's the X generation and the greatest generation, Tom Brokaw tells us, and I'm a part of the baby boomer generation. And then I'm told, aren't you lucky because your law clerks are going to be members of the millennial generation? That's quite a thing to be a member of the millennial generation. It means you only come along once in 1,000 years. Must be very special. But I do think that this generational mix is a very good thing. How can I live in the past with 4 young law clerks around me? And they can't get too futuristic or faddish because of me. And this difference in perspective is what the judicial process should try to aim for. I have a devotion to the academy. My background is as a professor and an academic to a considerable extent. And I remember when I sat once on a panel of 3 judges, and we went into conference to discuss the case we just heard, and I launched into some way up in the clouds, this is a very junior judge, very theoretical explanation, which might have impressed a very few of my colleagues at the coffee hour at the University of Virginia, but I was very proud of myself with this really, I thought, thoughtful, theoretical disquisition. So I propounded my view, and one of my colleagues looked at me after I had done this, about which I was so very proud, and he said, thank God there's only one academic on this court. And he's right. There's a great place for academics on the courts, but there's also a wonderful place for people who've been trial judges, understand what the trial process is like. There's also a great place on the courts for folks who've been in private practice. And I would hate to see a court without academics. I think it would be deprived of a very valuable perspective. But I'd also hate to see a court without trial judges and private practitioners. What we're looking for, and I think what produces good decisions, are people who come to the bench with different perspectives from one another. You gain a lot in this business just by listening. You know, we all reflect on how we spend our lives. Or would you do it all over again? People say, sure, I would. I think everybody on the bench could have earned a great deal of money somewhere else. More money. 10 times what we're earning in our occupation on the bench. But I wouldn't trade my job for anything. Not for anything. As just a satisfaction at the end of the day in feeling that you've tried to help somebody out. Feeling that you've done the best you could. That's a good feeling to, when you put your head down on your pillow, it's a good feeling to drive home from work on. And any amount of money could ever replace that. And then this great society functions because we keep order and liberty and intention and balance. And it is such a privilege to me to be vindicating those liberties protected by the Bill of Rights, great freedom of speech, freedoms protected, given to defendants in the criminal process. But it's also a real challenge to find the proper balance between liberty and between security, without which liberty cannot survive and flourish. Some people see liberty and security as in irreconcilable conflict. They are in conflict. The 20th century produced some terrible, terrible examples of dictators who can tell you what can happen to a society if it goes too far in the direction of security and entrusting too much to the powers of the state. But if you don't have a certain basic sense of security, a society turns inward on itself. People go forth less. They become fearful and suspicious of one another. They travel less. They engage in less commercial enterprise and risk-taking. So it's very important to have that basic level of security, too. Liberty and security are not always in conflict. Sometimes they are. But in other times, they're quite complementary. I want to just sort of end this on a bit of a personal note, if I may. While back, I was considered for the Supreme Court and had the opportunity to interview with a very fine man, President Bush, and for the job. And people ask me all the time, are you disappointed that you never made it to the Supreme Court? And yes. Of course. If I told you anything different, I wouldn't be telling the truth. I gave it everything I could within the limits of my principles, staying true to myself, and it didn't work out. And for a little while, I really felt very sorry for myself. And sometimes, feeling sorry for yourself is very justified. And sometimes feeling sorry for yourself can really be quite a bit of fun. It's fun and soothing in a certain way to feel underappreciated, misunderstood, the way you once did when your parents sent you up to your room. So I felt sorry for myself for a little while. And everybody has a right to feel sorry for themselves for a little while, but not indefinitely. And I looked at myself in the mirror one day and I said, Jay, you make a hell of a poor victim. So you got the best family and friends in the world. You got a community in Charlottesville that you love so much. You got a job that challenges you. Life has been bountiful. This country has been bountiful to you beyond measure. What more could you possibly ask or want? And there's a little poem, and I really kind of wish I knew who wrote it, but it appears in a lot of the anthologies, and it's only titled by Anonymous. But the poem has always meant a lot to me. And the poem reads as follows. There's laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. For the brave old earth lacks joy and mirth, but has sorrow enough of its own. And that's a great way to live. To just laugh and have the world laugh with you. And I'll tell you one thing that's made me feel mighty good about things, and that is that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito were simply wonderful choices. And so you feel good if the profession of which you're a part is well served by a president's decision. And I just feel in his two choices that President Bush chose two of the very best people there were. And knowing and seeing people of that splendid caliber on the Supreme Court has made me feel mighty good about things. So, what's not to like? It's Friday afternoon in Charlottesville. And we're on the edge of an absolutely beautiful weekend. We're here among the dogwood and in the company of friends. And I appreciate so much your coming here and Barbara, you and Bob, giving me the chance to speak in honor of my friend Henry. I'm going to have a slip of the tongue one of these days and call him Justice Abraham. He's such a distinguished student and commentator on the court that he merits that appellation. Henry, thank you again for everything you've meant to your students, to this university, to the Supreme Court, to your wonderful family, to your friends. It's such an honor to give a lecture in your name. Thank you so much.
Jay, I would have to say that we fully shared the disappointment of which you spoke, but you have helped us in many ways to regain perspective, and none, I think, more clearly than your extraordinarily personal but also highly informative, very sensitive view both from and of the bench, for which we are deeply grateful. Now, another rare opportunity. I said earlier that if you fill out the evaluation form, you may get your one and only chance to evaluate a federal judge. You also may now have your one and only opportunity to ask questions of a federal judge. As the lawyers here know, when you appear before the Fourth Circuit, you're down there, and Judge Wilkinson is up here, and he asks the questions. But uniquely this afternoon, he has agreed to respond to questions of which I'm sure some will follow, so we are now open to questions and or comments. If none is immediately forthcoming, let me take the privilege of the chair to raise an issue that I think was implicit in much of what you said. The people who wear the bright red robes in Maryland are different from you in one important respect. They do not have lifetime appointments, and you do. Any thoughts on how the federal judiciary is the beneficiary of that distinctive feature? As you know, Larry Sabato has recently in his book, which will be the subject of our program tomorrow afternoon, has raised serious questions. And indeed has gone so far as to suggest that the lifetime appointment should somehow change. There should be a specific time limit. So it just occurred to me that a question I've always wanted to ask, and the only person of whom you can ask it, is a federal judge.
I think the really important thing is that the judges enjoy a real measure of independence, that you can make a decision in terms of what you truly believe is right, in terms of the law, and in terms of your sense of justice of the case, and not fear reprisal. And I think that there is a grave danger if, in saying life tenure leads too much to a privileged autocracy, we were to undermine that basic independence by having judges fear that if they made an unpopular decision or somehow offended the interest of a powerful group, that they would be subject to retribution and reprisal. And I think that you have two branches of government which are properly subject to periodic elections every 2, 4, and 6 years. It's not a bad thing to have one branch of government have a sense of insulation and a sense of sometimes taking the long view of what the law requires and what the values of this country require and what its constitution and the intentions of its framers require, even if that doesn't seem to be the popular view at a particular moment. So this is a precious heritage, life tenure, that has stood us well, I think, over time. And sometimes even when you get upset with a particular decision, it's good not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there's a real danger in our state court system, Bob, of money affecting the judicial process. It's a different thing, I think, from the political process. But primarily, the controversies over class action litigation and punitive damages in tort suits and consumer-oriented litigation have roiled the state courts a great deal. And so there have been powerfully funded plaintiffs' groups and powerfully funded defendants' groups that are pouring money into judicial elections at an unheard of and unprecedented rate. And there is enormous pressure when that kind of money enters the judicial process, as it is in the state level, to have implicit quid pro quos that judges offer in return for funding. And nothing could be more subversive to what you and citizens should expect from the judicial process than to have that going on. And I think further that once one gets into office, there is a natural tendency on the part of a judge, because everybody is human, to understand who the benefactors were in the past election and whom the benefactors might be in the next election. And that is simply a bad road to travel. And so I would say that our lodestar ought to be a certain degree of independence, courage, and integrity on the part of the judicial branch. There are great dangers in judges having too much power and acting without a sufficient sense of modesty and restraint. But there are also huge dangers in undermining the independence of the judicial process and the integrity that each and every citizen ought to expect when he or she steps into court. Yes, sir, one of you.
Are you in favor of maybe an age limit? And I have a two-part question here.
Of age limits?
An age limit, and then I have a second part.
Sure.
The second part was that you don't think there should be, it should continue to be a lifetime appointment. How does the court manage the judge who's old and tottering and senile and so forth? What measures do you have?
Well, those are two really very good questions. Both of them are. You can point to some situations where judges were not as sharp late in their careers and justices were not as sharp late in their careers as they were earlier on. When you try to set a particular age limit, you may lose some really valuable and vital contributions. People age in different ways and at different rates. And given the fact that aging is an individual kind of process in many ways, you can't compare, oh, these two people are at the same age, therefore they're comparable in every other way. They're not. Aging is a very individual thing. And so I think it ought to be handled individually as far as is possible. I think of some of the examples of justices who have been made mighty contributions late into their 80s or 90s. I would have hated very badly for the Supreme Court to have been without the services of Hugo Black during his time when he was 80 to 85. He did some of his greatest work. There's a little story about Oliver Wendell Holmes, who served on the Supreme Court until well into his 90s. And he was walking around the perimeter of the Supreme Court with one of his fellow justices, and he was, I guess, toward the very end of his career, and he spotted a beautiful lady. And he said to his colleague, he said, "I ought to be 70 once more." You know, that kind of fellow still ought to be serving. When you take people like Holmes and you take people like Black, you wouldn't want to be without some of those contributions. Sometimes creativity becomes quite powerful in the later years. I think of Monet's great water lily paintings deep into his life, or John Milton's composition of Paradise Lost, or the beautiful portraiture of Frans Hals, the great Dutch artist. And I'm inclined to believe that law is not wholly different, and that there's something one can get from these great judges, even in their 70s or 80s, and just as one did from great artists and writers. But the gentleman's question had two parts, and certainly he points quite validly to the fact that there are people who remain on the bench longer than they should. And that, too, is a very valid point. What do you do with that? When I was Chief Judge of the Fourth Circuit, I tried to handle it very informally. If somebody was not on top of their game, it's human nature not want to leave the bench and the prerequisites that go with holding public office and your sense of being useful to other people and the sense of self-affirmation that you get from work. And so people sometimes, because they don't realize they've slipped, or because work is integral to their self-respect, they're very reluctant to leave. And that's what your question goes to. Even when they should leave, it's human nature not to leave. And I think probably the more so because a number of Supreme Court justices, for example, have died very soon after retiring. And a great many physicians will tell you that that keeping active may be the best thing. So when I dealt with situations where a trial judge or an appellate judge had begun to slip, I tried to talk to their families and get their families to make that approach. I thought it would be more sensitive coming from the family than from a colleague. It would embarrass the judge less. Trying to be sensitive by bringing family and friends into the process, and very oftentimes that really worked. But it's a dilemma, and it didn't always work. And I'll tell you another little story in response to your question. When Justice Stephen Fields stayed on the court into the late 1890s, and he'd begun to slip. And as a young man, Justice Field had gone to an aging justice, I think it was Justice Greer, and had told him it was time to step down because he wasn't really able to focus anymore. And so when Justice Field in 1896 or 1897 had begun to slip himself, some of his colleagues went to him. And one of them said, "Justice Field, do you remember when you were a very young justice that you went to, I think it was Justice Greer, and told him that it was appropriate, that the time had come for him to step down?" And Field, who'd been nodding off during most of the meeting, suddenly became very alert and said to his colleague, "Yeah, and a dirtier day's work I never did in my life." So what I'm saying, I'm saying that you put your finger on a real problem. There are pros and there are cons. There are ways of doing it. There are ways not to doing it. It's just not an easy question. Yes, sir.
In your opening of the lecture, you discussed some subjects you thought might be coming up for judges in the future. And I was struck that you didn't mention immigration. And yet we read every day about new laws being enacted. Is that something we're just overreading in the media? Or do you see a lot of immigration laws coming before the judges in the future?
We see all kinds of questions. And I think, by and large, the bench tries to take its lead from Congress in this particular matter. There's a feeling that the protection of the country's borders is to a considerable extent an attribute of sovereignty, and that it has dimensions of being an external affair as opposed to an internal affair. And so we try to take our lead from Congress, although there are great differences of opinions on how some of these immigration statutes should be interpreted. Where we do, and what the biggest increase in our docket is, are cases of political asylum. And political asylum in this country is that if somebody has shown that they have both a subjective and an objective fear of persecution, if they return to their home country, let's say someone were to come from Cambodia, and they could show that they, not just that general persecution was going on in the country, but that they or their family had been persecuted, and that if they returned to, let's say, Cambodia, they would be face persecution again, then they would file for political asylum. And the persecution has to be on account of their membership in a political, religious, or ethnic group. It can't just be for general reasons. And these cases are very difficult because they rest at large on what's often hard to say, and that is whether a judge believes, despite all the language difficulties and the difficulties in assembling information, really, about what's happening in Cambodia. It's very hard to get a handle on these cases because the applicant for political asylum is often not speaking. You're doing it through translation a lot, and in many situations, we're talking about conditions half the world away. And so the immigration judge makes a finding that this person's telling the truth. Everybody testifies that they fit within the statute. Everybody testifies that they want a political asylum because of persecution. Some people are telling the truth. Some people are legitimately facing dire straits and deserve political asylum. Others are handing you a bogus story. And these immigration judges have the frontline responsibility from discerning who really has a genuine claim, of which there are many, and who's trying to work the system. Those are the kinds of cases that we are seeing more and more of, and they're becoming a greater and greater percentage of the docket. And this is particularly true in border towns like Brownsville and Tucson and McAllen and San Diego, where we've had to have large infusions of judicial resources to deal with those kinds of cases. Thank you so much. I appreciate your coming, and I wish everyone a wonderful weekend.